Today on Against the Grain. In 2009, the mainstream, but democratically elected, government of Honduras was overthrown in a coup that was backed by the United States. Probably no surprise there. The U.S. has a long history of supporting repressive regimes in that country. But what was surprising, as my guest today argues, was the response of the, until then, fairly quiescent Honduran people. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Adrian Pine about violence, resignation, and rebellion in Honduras. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Honduras has the world's highest murder rate and is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. In her book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras, which was written before the 2009 U.S.-backed coup, medical anthropologist Adrian Pine posed the question, why don't Hondurans resist? Why do the poor often blame themselves for their lot in life rather than turning against the elite that own most of the country's wealth? Pine, who joins me, is associate professor at the American University and visiting professor of anthropology at UC Berkeley. Before we talk, Adrian, about how Hondurans see their plight and how that's changed after the coup, I wonder if you could tell us about Honduran society. What sort of social structure does it have?
That's a great question and a really big one. The reasons, I think, why Honduras has these indicators, right, the poorest country in the hemisphere, and it's always sort of battling with Haiti for that title, as well as in terms of the violence issue, it really are structural. And the fact that those two indicators have risen significantly since 2009 in particular has to do with the coup that was carried out in that year. On June 28th of 2009, with U.S. support, if not leading up to it, then certainly in the actions taken after the coup in support of the dictatorship of the regime. So what the coup did was to really intensify a program of neoliberal structural adjustment that had been already underway since, pretty seriously since the 90s, but you know, you could trace it back to earlier than that as well. And in intensifying this program of neoliberal structural adjustment, what that means in practice is, of course, that that people have less access to democracy. They have fewer protections. There's fewer worker protections. There is greater concentration of wealth and power among the elite, which Hondurans call the oligarchy, and which is an ethnically marked and very reduced elite of about 10 families. In a collaboration with multinational corporations who have been working on extractive and tourist projects that have effectively usurped land, water, and sovereignty from Hondurans. And so along with that, you see, of course, with the concentration of wealth, you see the increase of impoverishment in the country. And in order to implement that those policies, which are, of course, vastly unpopular, what the country has depended on is increasing investment in its military and police force, which has been combined into what some people call an alphabet soup of different agencies. You've got the military police, the national police, you know, different forms of the transit police, the military itself. And so the state has become an incredibly repressive state. Political assassinations happening, death squads within each of these different agencies of the police and military so they operate with impunity, and that impunity, you know, then becomes very widespread, so that, killing a poor person really isn't a crime in Honduras in the eyes of the state. And because there are no real avenues for a dignified life, you know, I think it's conducive to that, to the growth of this sort of violence.
Violence, of course, is not something new in the history of Honduras. I wonder if you could tell us just briefly about its colonial past and relationship to the United States.
Of course, the first European colonizers of Honduras were the Spanish, and then the British played a pretty significant role in Honduras as well, kind of in between and overlapping with the Spanish and the U.S. influence, which really takes hold in a strong way about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, with a banana industry. So you have these, you know, banana barons coming in from New Orleans and New York and bringing with them or hiring mercenary armies that, you know, would just take over the government anytime they weren't carrying out the policies that the banana folks wanted to benefit them, you know, that would create the greatest profit for them. And so the banana industry really helped to set up a particular relationship of dependency with the United States and a strong cultural ties also between New Orleans and the north coast of Honduras in particular. This is very fascinating sort of side history there. But the banana industry was what really determined along with mining, the silver and gold mining, determined the sort of way that infrastructure and politics developed over the 20th century in Honduras. You know, so you have the railroads that are built in Honduras, but they're primarily built in order to transport things that are mined and bananas to the North Coast, where they can be shipped to the United States, not for the benefit of Hondurans to get where they need to go. And then following that, the construction of roadways that are funded in large part by, you know, international lending institutions at this point are also similarly built not for necessarily for the benefit of Hondurans, but in the interests of the United States and international investors. And there were a series of dictatorships over the course of the 20th century that were U.S. friendly. In 1982, there was a sort of formal end to the dictatorships, in that there was this supposed democratic transition.
And this would have been at the time that the Nicaraguan Revolution was next door.
Right. This whole period, this is a tumultuous period, right, because you've got these revolutions springing up all around Honduras. Honduras did not have the revolutionary movements that you saw in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, to the extent that those grew, in part because the U.S. bases had such a strong presence. The U.S. had such a strong military presence in Honduras at the time. And also in part because under John D. Negroponte, who was the ambassador under Reagan in the early, in the mid-80s, there were CIA-trained death squads that Negroponte also had played a role in, the Battalion 316, which really made it its mission to pick off all of the leaders of who, you know, were potential revolutionary movement leaders. So they, you know, killed a couple hundred people at that time. And I mean, that is something that is very present in the memory of Hondurans. When I first started working in Honduras in the late 90s, you know, it was sort of a never again memory. And yet what we see today is far more violent and far worse. And, you know, the death count is far higher than what happened in the 1980s. But all this to say that that as the U.S. used Honduras as its military base and training ground for the Contras in Nicaragua and for fighting against the FMLN in El Salvador, they also were able to suppress any sort of similar uprising in Honduras. Another part of that was land reforms that were more sort of liberal, I think, that, you know, that helped to mitigate some of the things that people were becoming indignant about in neighboring countries just enough so that there was not as much of an urge to join a revolutionary movement as in the other countries. So there were a lot of factors at play.
What does the economy of Honduras look like now?
In terms of industries in Honduras, the maquiladora industry is a very important sector. African palm growth has been, or that's an important export industry as well, but employs relatively few people compared to other industries, which is one reason that it's so attractive to, you know, large agribusiness and landowners in Honduras. Really, what's keeping the economy afloat is remittances, which is why the recent announcement of the cancellation of TPS, of temporary protective status, is a huge threat to the Honduran economy.
And you mean remittances, Hondurans who are abroad sending money back?
That's right.
And how important has the United States been as a destination for Honduran migrants?
Well, of course, the irony is that United States policy is the reason why Hondurans are leaving Honduras.
Sure.
And the United States is at the same time, as dangerous as it is to come here and to be here, the United States is seen by many as the safest destination to come to. You know, I have interviewed many hundreds of Hondurans over the course of the past two decades. Very few of them want to come to the United States because they believe in the American dream. The people who I know who have left, it's been largely out of, in particular since the coup, out of fear and despair. You know, there might have been people, I think when I first started working there, there were ideas about, you know, you could make a lot of money, but people don't even talk about that anymore now. They're just trying to save their lives.
I'm speaking with medical anthropologist Adrian Pine. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what you wrote about in your book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras, you wrote about and explored the circumstances of ordinary Hondurans and how they see their lot in life and how they deal with the violence, the structural violence of the situation they find themselves in. How would you describe daily life in Honduras for the majority of people, and how does violence manifest itself in daily life?
So daily life in Honduras, in particular in the urban centers, which is where I spent more of my time than in rural areas, although I've done work in rural areas as well, is really influenced in every way by the fear of violence. I don't want to exoticize it in any way because structurally I don't think it's any different from the United States, but it's different from what those of us who are more privileged in the United States, who are, you know, who do not live in communities that are subject to police, militarized police brutality, experience. But you know, on a day-to-day basis, what struck me very acutely in my first periods of field work was that I could not leave the house I was staying in without people saying, be careful out there, they killed somebody the other day, you might get stabbed, you might get raped, you know, these sort of constant warnings about bodily danger and the terrible things that could happen to you and the ever-present fear that people reinforce all the time, both in their daily discussions, but also in the media, where you're seeing pictures of really violent, brutal death in, you know, on every single newspaper page.
And are these, by and large, deaths caused by other civilians or state violence?
Well, that's the thing, is that the discourse is primarily focused on poor on poor violence, right? So it's in particular focusing on gangs, which in the 90s when I started, in the late 90s when I started doing field work, gangs were, you know, had been in Honduras for 5 or 6 years, were starting to be seen, or, you know, were seen at that point as a terrifying menace, as, you know, as sort of a different kind of species, even though, you know, you might have, they might be your neighbors, but there was this othering that happened when people talked about gangs, that made people really focus in on that lack of humanity and somehow talk about gangs as if it were a cultural problem and not a problem of structural violence, which is how I came to see it.
And then, how does state violence play a role in people's daily lives?
Well, today, after the coup in particular, it's, I think, much more clear to a lot of Hondurans the day-to-day role that state violence plays in people's lives, in part because the militarization is more obvious. You're seeing military police walking around, you know, heavily armed, Kevlar vests on, you know, military gear, riot gear. I mean, you could see them every day. So that's more evident. But I think that the ways that the state violence is even more harmful are some of the ways that it's not necessarily so obviously visible. And that is really, you know, if you think about gangs, well, like, what's their origin? And, you know, their origin really is in U.S.-funded wars in the 1980s, in El Salvador in particular, where, you know, you have all of these refugees from this war going to the United States, kids, you know, forming these neighborhood groups in Los Angeles and other cities where they are alienated from the local communities and trying to, you know, find community in that way. And then, you know, getting deported in the mid-90s and then onward to countries that they had never lived in, where many of them didn't even speak the language. And so then you get all these Central Americans in the mid-90s deported to their countries of birth, forming gangs because they find themselves in the same situation where they don't have community, they don't speak the language, all of that. And so that, you know, there's this U.S.-caused social problem that is exacerbated by the Honduran government's economic policies, again, to some degree imposed by the U.S. through the IMF and the restructuring conditions of the loans that they're being given, where the employment sector has really ensured that young men are unemployable because you have this move toward maquiladora factories. Today, there are more young men, there's almost parity between men and women being employed in the maquiladora factories. But in the 90s in particular, it was far more women than men, and girls, too. I mean, there were really a lot of underage employment. So what you have is this phenomenon where young men are become an excess demographic. This is what neoliberalism does, I think, is make young men more vulnerable, and, you know, and need to defend themselves in other ways and find other ways of community and other ways of making money. And unfortunately, for many of them, that ended up meaning joining gangs. And, you know, which isn't to say that everybody does this out of desperation. Certainly some people join gangs because it seems like an exciting and sexy and attractive thing to do. But for many people, it's the only opportunity. And I think that is what is invisibilized in this othering of gang members and this criminalization and this talk of them that makes them look like they are the cause of all the problems, as opposed to these broader structural factors that have to do with imperialism and capitalism.
What had been the role of alcohol in people's lives? You chose to write about that in your anthropological work there.
Well, I chose to write about alcohol In part because I found it interesting because people talked about alcohol in a very similar way to the way in which they talked about violence. You know, there's a sort of conflation of alcohol and danger, and people who were labeled as alcoholics, there was it was like, you know, poor people are alcoholics and alcoholics are poor people. There was this sort of conflation that, of course, is, you know, counterfactual. But also reinforce these ideas that that poverty is a cultural problem rather than a structural and economic problem, because what people were taught to do in getting sober was to act wealthier. This is not literally what they were taught to do, but I mean, in effect, when they went to AA meetings or when they went to church and sort of learned how to be sober, they were also learning to affect what I called a sort of bourgeois habitus. I mean, they were supposed to start talking in a way that didn't sound as street. They were supposed to start dressing in ways that made them appear more civilized. I'm putting this in scare quotes. I mean, the thing is that acting bourgeois didn't make them any richer. It didn't give them any more real power in society, but it played right into this notion that that people are drunks because they're lazy, because they have bad moral character, you know, and that people are poor because they're drunks. So which, again, takes all of the blame off of the structure and puts it back onto poor people.
So in 2009, there was a military coup in Honduras, which you've referred to, which ousted President Manuel Zelaya and sent him into exile. What happened? What were the circumstances that led up to the coup? And how was the United States involved in it and its aftermath?
Well, leading up to the coup, Manuel Zelaya, who was elected as a liberal, and in Honduras, there's a two-party system, basically, or at least up until the coup and several years after there was, with the National Party and the Liberal Party, which are basically, I mean, you could basically call them the equivalent of the Republican and the Democrats, and that they're both capitalist neoliberal parties, but one of them is you know, more sort of militaristic, and the other one has sort of window dressing, like liberal, social liberal policies. So Manuel Zelaya, who was elected as a liberal and was very much a neoliberal, he was the one responsible for pushing CAFTA through, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which is, you know, had a terrible impact on the health and well-being of Hondurans. And his policies were good for business. I mean, the industry, you know, really thrived under him. But he also carried out a number of policy changes that were mild pushbacks against sort of raw neoliberalism, raw, you know, market values. So these included increasing a pension system for the elderly, increasing access to education, you know, and school lunches and things like that, and significantly increasing the minimum wage quite a bit, which gained him, as you can imagine, a lot of popularity with social movements. And then the straw that really broke the camel's back for the oligarchy of Honduras was that he responded to social movement demands for him to hold a constituent assembly to rewrite the Constitution of 1982, which was written while still under a military dictatorship, but as part of the transition to democracy, and which really guarantees an intense concentration of power in Honduras among a few figures, which has, you know, led to its continuation. So he had agreed to hold a non-binding poll asking whether or not Hondurans wanted to have a referendum on whether or not to have a constituent assembly to rewrite the Constitution. So the poll was going to be on June 28th, 2009, and the referendum would have been as part of the regular elections in November of that year. The elite groups in Honduras saw that as such a threat that they, in order to prevent that non-binding poll from being carried out. They overthrew them. So what we saw that day was SOA Watch trained general Romeo.
This is the School of the Americas.
Right. School of the Americas trained General Romeo Vasquez Velasquez, along with other, elite members of the Honduran military, also trained at the School of the Americas, raid Zelaya's house in the very early hours of the morning, take him out, and put him in a plane. The plane stopped for 15 or 20 minutes at the U.S. military base to refuel, and then flew him to Costa Rica, still famously in his pajamas. That detail they never leave out. On the following day, there was a very strongly worded declaration from the Organization of American States that this had been illegal, it had been a coup, and that the only resolution was for Manuel Zelaya to return to power. And that was unanimously approved. But just days later, the State Department, so this was when Hillary Clinton was head of the State Department, announced that there were going to be negotiations that were basically between the State Department, led in name by Oscar Arias, who's the president at the time of Costa Rica, and he was a Nobel Peace Prize winner for his role in negotiating the so-called peace in Central America following the wars, including the Micheletti government, which was the dictatorship in Honduras, as a legitimate bargaining partner. So the U.S., despite having approved this, been a party to this unanimous decision to not recognize the usurping government in Honduras, immediately turned around and recognized it effectively as a legitimate bargaining partner in whatever the transition was going to be. So they completely undercut the OAS, which led to a serious shift in U.S. Latin American relations right then. And basically, from then on continued to exacerbate this position, which supported the Micheletti administration and undermined Zelaya and the people who opposed the coup, who were wrongly and consistently called Zelaya followers in the U.S. and Honduran press, when many of them were not even fans of Zelaya, but just opposed the coup.
So what happened domestically following the coup, both in terms of the new regime and opposition to the coup?
Well, it was really an amazing thing. One of the big questions I had in my book, which came out the previous year, just about a year before the coup, was why aren't Hondurans resisting this incredible neoliberal violence on a larger scale? There were certainly, groups that have, been powerful organizing, mobilizing groups at a local and even regional level, like COPIN, which was founded by Berta Cáceres, who was murdered a couple years ago, and Ofrane, headed by another incredibly strong Afro-Indigenous woman, Miriam Miranda. But apart from that, there were not the kind of nationwide or large-scale movements that that you see in other countries. There were some good solid unions, but student movements, but I was just seeing the scale of the violence being carried out against Hondurans. That was a question. So what was surprising to me, and to everybody I have talked to in Honduras, was the intensity of the and immediacy of the resistance movement. From the morning that the coup took place, people came out, poured out onto the streets, and protested. And from the very first day, they were tear gassed and attacked and shot at, by the police and the state security forces. And they just kept coming out every single day that year. And it became developed a culture and even a sort of institutionalization in certain forms of protest and resistance that had not previously existed, at least in recent decades, in Honduras. And so that was really, you know, the first day and the time that followed was like it was really the first days of what became the National People's Resistance Front, the FNRP, which was strong for a couple years after the coup. I mean, really for the period between the coup and the elections that the U.S. used to completely legitimate the coup. But then it continued to be a force for a year or so after, until it became it was transformed in large part into an electoral party, which was caused a big split between the movement because there were a lot of people who argued that that the resistance wasn't ready to become an electoral party, and also that the conditions were not adequate for there to be free and fair elections, which of course has turned out to be the case, as we've seen in the elections that have happened since the coup, each of which have been fraudulent, and the most recent one in November 2017 was so blatantly fraudulent that, you know, they killed at least 38 people in the months following the elections who were protesting the fraud, and jailed 26 political prisoners, about half of which have now been let out on bail, but the rest of them are still imprisoned. And I mean, so it was so blatant that, you know, they had to really carry out incredibly violent repressive measures to implement the new dictatorship, to keep Juan Orlando Hernandez, the dictator, in power. But also at his inauguration, you didn't have a single foreign dignitary show up. I mean, so there was an international kind of subtle acknowledgement that these elections were not legitimate. Nonetheless, the United States was, of course, the first in congratulating him on his so-called win.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Adrienne Pine. She's a medical anthropologist, and she wrote a book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras, which was published by the University of California Press, based on her work in Honduras about structural violence and how Hondurans saw themselves. That was written before the 2009 coup, and we're talking about the violence of Honduran society and the resistance to it, and how the way that Hondurans see themselves has changed over time. I wanted to ask you a little more about just immediately after the coup. You said that Honduras was a place where there had been much less resistance than in other countries in Central America, and yet people just started pouring out into the streets. What was sort of the glue that kept people coming? Because if you didn't have, I mean, one of the conundrums for places that where there isn't a lot of resistance is it becomes sometimes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when something happens, it's much harder for people to get in touch with each other, particularly if there's violence coming from above, motivate each other to get out there. Was it initially spontaneous and then connections were made very quickly? What happened?
Well, it was. It was spontaneous. And, you know, and I think one of the issues of not having had that prior organization at the grassroots level was that, you know, that it's an unreliable sort of resistance. It's, you know, a massive people come out on the streets and there's this moment of resistance euphoria, but that doesn't necessarily translate into long-term, you know, sort of structures or processes of resistance against the broader forces. I think what brought people out was that they really actually had a deep belief that what they had was democracy. And what, you know, from some of the slogans that that really came out during the coup or after the coup, you know, in the period of the height of resistance following the coup had to do with, you know, our blindfolds have been taken off. You know, now we can see who the real enemy is. A sort of recognition that, wow, actually, we didn't have democracy before, but we thought we did. But this made it really clear. So, you know, I think it was that indignation that, you know, hey, we voted for this guy. That was our democracy, right? Which isn't necessarily the same thing as recognizing the broader violence of imperialist capitalism and neoliberal policy, but rather sort of recognizing the usurpation of that particular form of, you know, of exercising their voice. And so people were really indignant about that, and that brought them together. But in the process, of course, of protesting, I mean, that was a pedagogical process. I mean, people were learning from each other. People were coming into contact with people that they would not have normally come into contact in their everyday lives. And I mean, it was a moment that was really exciting, you know, for feminist groups, for the LGBT groups, who had largely been confined in their advocacy to just that, to like advocacy, right? Not necessarily to revolutionary projects, but to the confines of the NGO world, you know. So you had people doing a lot of education on sexism, or education on homophobia, or like AIDS prevention projects, but not necessarily having the liberty through the structures of the, you know, nonprofits that formed most of, you know, the hubs of organization for feminist and LGBT organizing, that, you know, didn't really permit people to go beyond and criticize the structures of power. But you had these people who were now going beyond that, and, you know, and LGBT leaders who became resistance leaders on their own right without having to identify first as LGBT leaders, but in the process forced the Honduran left to reckon with their deeply ingrained homophobia and transphobia and sexism. And so, you know, you had the feminists were out there again from day one, and they had the best slogans, you know. They had, one of them was, it doesn't translate so easily, but ni golpes de Estado, ni golpes a las mujeres, which is, golpe is coup, but it also means a blow in Spanish. So it was basically no punching the government, no punching women, but tying those two together and showing that, you know, misogyny is part and parcel of these processes of state power and consolidation. And so there's this education that was going on the street, you know, about those processes, about processes of in the ways that everybody, including the left, participates in forms of violence and violent forms of power, but also processes in which people really started recognizing, above and beyond the usurpation of their electoral democracy, the structures that were preventing that democracy from ever having really been possible, which have to do with the control that, you know, that the IMF, the World Bank, and, you know, ultimately the United States, which controls both of those institutions, and the, you know, military occupation have over Hondurans' day-to-day lives. So these are things that I would say a lot of Hondurans really didn't think about a lot before the coup. Of course, there were some who thought about it very much, but many more people through the process of these daily marches became much more politicized.
How do you think poor Hondurans saw themselves before the coup and saw their situation, their lot in life before the coup and then after the coup? And has it changed between the post-coup period and now?
Such a complicated and tricky question. I mean, first of all, obviously, we can't generalize about all poor Hondurans.
Sure.
But one thing that I found in doing the ethnographic research for my book, which the bulk of the research I did between like 97 and 2003, was that a lot of my friends who lived in the poor communities that that I was living in when I was doing research, much to my surprise, were very much in support of repressive state policies that I saw as killing them and their communities. And I mean this quite literally. And really what they were zero tolerance policies that were brought in by Rudy Giuliani in the early 2000s that justified the criminalization of poor people. And in so doing, morally, if not legally, justified the death squads that were picking off young men in particular, but also some young women who were criminalized through this process of identifying them with gang members. So there was this sort of identity crime that was justifying what they euphemistically called street cleansing, which, of course, referred to killing off the excess demographic, the people who were impoverished by these very policies. And the most immediate threats that people in these poor neighborhoods felt to their lives were indeed from other poor people. Those were the fears that they felt, whether or not they, were grounded. But, of course, they were grounded because they were seeing violence like this on a day-to-day basis, and they weren't necessarily seeing the structures behind it. I mean, that's the tricky part about how structural violence works is that it invisibilizes itself. And So I found people whose own children had been shot at by these death squads actively supporting the killing of their neighbors by police because something had to happen. That was what I heard over and over again in the mid-2000s or early mid-2000s was things were so bad that something had to happen, and it's too bad that it had to be this way, but at least, they've killed off all the gang members. And, so that was sort of became another one of the central questions of my book is how could people support these policies that are killing them? And but again, that's not I don't want to generalize to all poor people because there were lots of poor people who were protesting it or who were against it, but fewer than I would have expected. That changed after the coup.
And I should say I'm speaking with Adrian Pine about structural violence in Honduras. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So following the 2009 coup, when all sorts of people who I think perhaps could be described as apolitical or depoliticized came out in the streets in large numbers. How did that shift widely held perceptions about the situation that Hondurans were in?
So for that period, and I would identify this period as sort of the period where there was resistance, the period where people talked about their blindfolds having been removed, I would say that was for a couple years after the coup. People suddenly diverted their hostility away from the gangs and toward the people who were responsible for the coup, toward the oligarchs in Honduras who had funded the coup and the repressive apparatus of the state, and toward the politicians as well who were part of that. And I mean, there's something that was very interesting that happened that during that point, the gangs they were structurally also victims of these same oligarchic parties, right? I mean, they're the ones who are the targets of their policy, and they're the ones who are, to some degree, just as or even more vulnerable than the people who are terrified of them. So you had gangs actually becoming politicized, turning to resistance members, protecting neighborhoods from the police, keeping the police out. It's a really fascinating topsy-turvy moment. But of course, with the repression and with the turn towards the electoral turn, I think, that the resistance movement took, which was, of course, very much U.S. supported, the resistance really lost its focus on grassroots mobilizing, on building that broader movement capacity, because most of that really got channeled into the electoral process. And along with that, you know, you saw the really re-entrenchment of this ideology that the elite were really invested in criminalizing the poor, and in particular criminalizing gang members, and getting people to forget that it's the elite themselves that are causing all of this violence on a broader level, because it's easier to see the gang members who are sort of the hitmen of capitalism as the ones who are causing the violence, because you see them with the guns. And, you know, they're the ones who are directly threatening you and directly threatening your lives. And of course, you know, people are afraid of them. But there's, there's a really intentional process in, you know, from 2010 onward of recriminalizing impoverished people. But in this case, you know, in the early 2000s, it was, I think, a process of criminalizing poverty. But following the coup, it added on criminalizing dissent. And so that's been the real focus of legislation and policy that has followed the regimes of Pepe Lobo, who was the president following the coup, you know, elected in quotes in 2009, and then Juan Orlando Hernandez, who is now in his second illegitimate term as president. They've really focused on passing new laws. There have been several sort of anti-terrorism laws, which basically identify anybody who disagrees with the regime as a terrorist, which, you know, again, justify the criminalization, the taking of political prisoners, and really stifling the hopes and dreams of people who want to have control over their lives and their land.
Who was Berta Cáceres, and what were the circumstances around her assassination?
Berta was an incredible organizer, but also just a wonderful person. She had this raucous laugh. She was so full of life, and she's known here as an indigenous environmentalist. Those are sort of the labels that have stuck internationally. And there are, I think, strategic reasons for that. But that really doesn't come close to describing who she was. She was a leader in an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, anti-militarization movement. And I mean, all of the interviews that, you know, that I have recorded with her, where she's talking about things, she never decouples environmentalism or indigeneity from these structural factors, which is how we tend to do it in the United States. We don't necessarily link those things as successfully. And she was a leader of the FNRP because she was one of the people who had actually been doing this grassroots organizing. Copin just celebrated, I think it's 30 years. I can't remember exactly how many years, but, you know, it's been several decades that since she founded it. Copin is an organization. It's a council, Popular Council of Indigenous Peoples of Honduras, primarily made up of Lenca people in Honduras, and just an amazing job of organizing people, many of whom did not even necessarily recognize their indigenous roots, because there's been such racism in Honduras over the decades, and people have been encouraged to hide their indigenous ancestry. And so there was one of the projects was reclaiming that indigenous ancestry as part of also recognizing the connections that that people in those regions and Lempira and elsewhere had with the lands. And that was part and parcel of the struggle against the huge corporations that have been, carrying out extractive projects that often are focused in indigenous territories in Honduras. So you have the Patuca Dams in the Mosquitia region that have been devastating to the indigenous mosquito population. You have massive tourist projects that are taking away vast swaths of Garifuna land on the north coast. And then in the Lenca territory, you have these, dam projects again, and So Berta's, the struggle that she was killed over had to do with the Rio Hualcarque and the project, the Agua Zarca, the dam that was a project, a joint project of a Chinese corporation and Honduran investors who had played a central role in the coup. And the Rio Blanco community, where that dam was going to, you know, it was basically, it was going to devastate the community. It was going to remove their access to water. It was going to make life unsustainable. Were protesting, and Berta and Copin were strongly supporting those protests. There had already been several members of Copin, or I think two, had already been assassinated in that struggle. And Berta had been harassed, threatened by the Honduran government, by the officials from the corporation. But she just kept fighting. They were succeeding. I mean, they had such international support because of really the courage that they had and the militancy of their struggle. We all thought, you know, those of us who knew Berta and who were in solidarity, thought that she was too big for them to kill. We thought that, you know, they had had a pattern, the Honduran state had had a pattern of killing off the middle-level resistance leaders or the family members of high-level resistance leaders, but never the people who were the most famous. And Berta, having traveled numerous times to the United States to give testimony in the Inter-American Commission to speak, and then just having won the Goldman Prize the previous year, I mean, we just all thought they would never dare kill Berta, but they did.
Adrienne Pine, thank you so much for joining me. I've been speaking with Adrienne Pine. She is a medical anthropologist. She's associate professor at American University, where she directs the Health Inequity and Care Program, and she's a visiting associate professor of anthropology at UC Berkeley. You can find a link to her book, Working Hard, Drinking Hard, on Violence and Survival in Honduras, on our website, againstthegrain.org. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.